Hi there, I'm Tom Schultz, host of Voices of Montana, an issue-oriented newsmaker radio program. It's heard weekdays on 19 radio stations with 28 signals all across our great treasure state. Thank you for clicking on the podcast. Please subscribe, and we'll do our best to keep you connected. We're also on Facebook and on the web at voicesofmontana.com, where I'd love to hear from you. Please contact me at tom@voicesofmontana.com. Oh, we get to talk about the underground today. Yes, not that kind, Cody. The actual real underground. I mean, where earthquakes and volcanoes erupt. That kind of science. The kind of science that you can grab onto. 4.2 earthquake recently in Great Falls. We'll talk about that. What does that mean? Is there increased seismic activity? Not necessarily. We look at Yellowstone and they actually had fewer recorded seismic events in this last year. Does that mean they're all saving up for this year? I don't know. But I know someone who can tell us a bit more than we do know about it. Dr. Jamie Farrell with the Yellowstone Volcano Observatory. So today we're going to get geeky on science, on voices. These are some really interesting things. The earthquake and volcanic dynamics. We look at Yellowstone is just right in our backyard, and it's one of the most active and unique seismic and volcanic centers in the entire world. So it's pretty cool. And we get to chat with Dr. Jamie Farrell from time to time as well, associate professor, University of Utah, chief seismologist at the Yellowstone Volcano Observatory. Dr. Farrell, good morning. How you doing, Jamie?
Good morning. I'm doing well. How about yourself?
Good. Nothing. Nothing's going on here. What's shaking in your world?
Actually, a lot more than most people might think.
Oh.
They can't feel them, but we can.
Yeah, right? I noted, we'll talk about this earthquake in Great Falls, but I noted as I'm looking at some research that, earthquakes 1,500 to 2,500 a year in the Yellowstone area, but this last year there wasn't even 1,500. Is that right?
That's correct. It was a little bit of a slow year in Yellowstone.
Is the Earth saving up?
I hope not.
Yeah. Right?
This happens. We've had years where we've had less than 1,000 earthquakes, and then we've had years where we have over 3,000 earthquakes. So, that 1,500 to 2,500 is a long-term average, but it's never always in that range.
And one of the things that for such a long time, we have tasked, I think, our seismologists to try and predict earthquakes. But, everything that you're working with, the patterns just don't seem to add up always to where you can do that, right?
Yeah, earthquake prediction is, the holy grail of seismology. It hasn't come to fruition yet. We can forecast earthquakes given past recordings, so we can say, okay, there's a probability of, this size magnitude earthquake coming in a certain amount of time, but we can't predict earthquakes.
Are you getting any closer? Will it ever be possible?
I don't know that. If I did know that, I would be a lot wealthier than I am right now.
Right.
Sure. That's for sure.
Oh, Cody says, does AI help?
AI for sure helps us identify earthquakes. We use AI quite a bit to identify really small earthquakes in seismic noise, ones that are too small for the human eye to see, but we can recognize them using machine learning or AI. And then that's certainly an area of active research of using AI to recognize patterns to see maybe there is small little things that happen before a big earthquake. That's certainly, like I said, an area of research right now, but it hasn't come to fruition as of yet.
Dr. Jamie Farrell, our guest once again, associate professor of research, University of Utah, chief seismologist at the Yellowstone Volcano Observatory. A lot of experience with these dynamics and as we're talking about hazard analysis and a PhD in geophysics from the University of Utah. So a lot of time spent in our area, Jamie, and thanks for coming on. I appreciate that. What does the 4.2 earthquake in central Montana mean?
Well, it has nothing to do with Yellowstone.
Yep.
It's Montana is a seismically active state. Now, this earthquake that occurred on the 29th of January, it didn't happen in an area that typically sees a lot of earthquakes. It's a little bit east of where most of the earthquakes you know, the active seismic area of Montana is. But, you know, it's not surprising to see an earthquake there. That's happened before. Yeah, a little bit odd, but not, you know, end of the world stuff for sure.
Is there a belt? Is it the Intermountain Seismic Belt? Is this all
That's
a part
correct.
Of that? Yeah. Yeah. Talk about what yep. happened there.
So the Intermountain Seismic Belt is an area of active seismicity that extends all the way from southwestern Utah, kind of Arizona, Nevada area, all the way up through the wall along the Wasatch Front in Utah, up through Wyoming, through the Tetons, through Yellowstone, and then kind of bends out of Yellowstone up through Montana, almost all the way up to the Canadian border. And this is an area of the western U.S. where we see active seismicity, large faults, and at least in, it's kind of associated with the Basin and Range. The Basin and Range is an area of the western U.S. that's actively extending in an east-west fashion, and it's kind of on the border of that, the eastern border of that Basin and Range province. So an area where we see lots of earthquakes, yeah, so like I said, it's not out of the ordinary to see earthquakes, although the Great Falls earthquake was a little bit more to the east of that typical area.
Do we still see, is this a plate tectonic thing or something within a singular plate? Or is it is there tectonic involved going under or over in our areas?
This is for surely tectonic related. It's not a plate boundary. This is all within the North American plate. The plate boundary is the San Andreas Fault in California and then off the coast of the Pacific Northwest. But this is just an area, like a boundary between two, say, tectonic provinces within the North American plate. So you have to the east, at least in Utah, you have the Rocky Mountain province to the east. In Montana, you probably have more of, you know, stable North America, cratonic rocks, thick, cold, old rocks, and then to the west, you have actively extending rocks.
So we see a 4.2 earthquake on the Richter scale. You know, kind of help us understand what that is. I think there was another follow-up earthquake as well. That was like 3-point-something, too. But that one was hardly even mentioned or hardly even felt. How do we feel a 4.2 but not a 3.2?
Well, you have to think about what the magnitude scale is. So the magnitude scale is what's called a logarithmic scale. So every unit of the magnitude scale, say like from a 3.2 to a 4.2, that's 10 times the amount of energy. So the 4.2 is 10 times larger than a 3.2. It's easy to see why so many more people felt. So for example, the 4.2 right now currently has a little under 1,000 felt reports on it. So 1,000 people logged on to the USGS website and reported feeling that event. The 3.2 has 197 felt reports. Not all of those are probably real, but that's how many felt reports were logged on. And then there was one other aftershock, a 2.7, and that has 19 felt reports. So you have to understand the magnitude scale being a logarithmic scale. It's not linear. So a 4.2 is much larger than a 3.2.
Yeah, thanks for explaining that. I mean, I think that's a lot of people try to understand that as well. We know when we look at like large dramatic earthquakes, and there's been some activity around the world, but that's kind of always the case. We know the ones that are like super dangerous. But you know, 4.2 was pretty significant. You get to, have we ever, what's the highest magnitude earthquake that we have felt recently in Montana that you can, you know, recall?
I don't know about recently. The largest earthquake in Montana is probably the 1959 Hebgen Lake earthquake, magnitude 7.3, just west of Yellowstone National Park. That event caused a large rock slide, and it killed 28 people. So that's probably the largest event, I think, is probably the largest event in Montana history.
So 7.3, and I think people who have, and we've done shows on the anniversary of that earthquake wasn't that long ago, and so we've talked about that, and 7.3, it's quite extensive. So, you know, we kind of, when we start getting near those numbers, and especially, I think, Jamie, you know, our proximity to, well, the Ring of Fire, to the coast, as well as Yellowstone National Park, I guess I'm always curious about how these are all connected. And I think, I don't know, they're probably all connected in some way, but it's hard to find out where that vein is, I suppose.
Well, not everything's connected. I mean, I mean, we're all part of the earth, so I guess they're connected that in that way.
Right.
But like earthquakes in California or, you know, volcanoes in the Pacific Northwest, they have nothing to do with Yellowstone or Montana. They're completely different systems. And one would not affect the other.
So you don't see that. I mean, you've never seen that. And I guess I find that curious, too, because I would think, you know, we're still a pretty closed system being in one body here. I guess I'm curious or if you're curious as to why there's that much separation.
Well, they're just too far apart from each other. So the effects of one can't reach the other. Now, there is ways for things far away to affect our region. For example, in 2004, there was a magnitude 7.9 earthquake in Alaska. We call this the Denali earthquake. And that earthquake sent seismic waves straight down through North America. And as those seismic waves traveled through the western U.S., and particularly in Yellowstone, as they traveled through Yellowstone, they triggered a bunch of local earthquakes in Yellowstone and triggered a bunch of seismic activity as well. So there are ways for far-off things to affect us here, but the two systems are not directly connected, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I do. I get that. Do you see waves, seismic waves? Does your instrument pick it up like we would see a wave on the ocean?
Oh, yeah, for sure. Yeah. I mean, you can – there are pretty neat animations on the web. And, you know, as if you look at all the seismometers, say, in the western U.S. or in the U.S., and you plot them a certain way as seismic waves from a big earthquake travel through the U.S., you can clearly see the waves traveling through the U.S. in the direction they're going. So, yeah, you can for sure see those seismic waves as they travel through the earth.
You know, just curiosity about these things kind of spur us on to investigate seismic activity and volcanic activity as well. Kilauea has just been putting on a show lately. We will talk about that. That's volcano in the Hawaiian island chain. And so we'll talk about that here a bit later on. Our guest today is Dr. Jamie Farrell with the Yellowstone Volcano Observatory. And I got a number of articles here off of that website. It's usgs.gov. And just do any search. It'll come right up, the Caldera Chronicles. One of the things that is highlighted there in an article is the Norris Uplift Anomaly. So I encourage you guys who are curious about that to go to that. And Dr. Farrell, thanks for being here again. I guess some of the key things that are interesting about this, you know, tell us what this ground deformation is, an uplift, and you know, what's curious about this?
Yeah, so I think first thing to say is that, you know, Yellowstone is an active volcanic system. It's dynamic. So we see ground deformation quite a bit in Yellowstone. For the last, say, 10 to 12 years, the caldera has been going down. It's been deflating, in a sense. But in Yellowstone, we kind of see two main areas of ground deformation. We have the caldera. Like I said, it's been going down. But we have this area around Norris that tends to be doing the opposite. It hasn't been very active as of late, but we noticed in starting in July of 2025, instrumentation in that area has shown that it has now returned to a period of uplift. Now, it's not super fast. It's not alarming. I think at this point, it's probably only uplifted less than an inch, probably total at this point. But we'll see how it goes in the future. This is an area that's gone up and down in the past. We know about it. One thing interesting about this current episode of uplift, at this point, it seems to be associated with increased seismicity. So we've had a couple earthquake swarms that have occurred right in the center of uplift. So, you know, what does this mean? Does this mean that there's, you know, fluids moving around down there that's causing this uplift, that's also breaking the ground, causing earthquakes? That's something that we'll look into and see how this progresses in the future.
How much drilling do you do when you try to research this? So, or is it most, I mean, and does drilling present a danger? So I would imagine it does. So you're probably trying to do all this kind of work, size with instruments, I presume, but, you know, educate me on that. How do you drill down to try to find some answers here?
We don't do any drilling in the park. Actually, there are some drill holes in the park. There are some old research drill holes that the USGS drilled. We have a handful of instruments that are down in boreholes, what we call, you know, that we drilled, and they put them down in the ground. But most of this research is done just by instruments on the surface. Drilling can be very disruptive to the hydrothermal system in Yellowstone. You have to be really careful.
I would presume. I mean, because they're poking holes all by themselves in a lot of different areas, right? I mean, haven't we seen that in the lower geyser basin?
Oh yeah. I mean, the only reason you have this spectacular superficial geothermal features in Yellowstone is because there are a lot of cracks in the ground. There are a lot of ways for water to move through the ground. They wouldn't occur if we didn't have that. So, you know, if you drill your own hole, that kind of steals water and heat from the natural system, then that can really affect the wonderful geothermal features we have in Yellowstone.
Yeah, and the science behind it. I mean, you want to leave that as natural as you can, so you can get every bit of information from what you can discover and know it's natural and not artificial. You know, it strikes me here, and Dr. Jamie Farrell is our guest here again from the Yellowstone Volcano Observatory, the chief seismologist there as well. It's not necessarily on our plate to talk about, but I've been doing a number of series on energy here, and, you know, geothermal comes up as one of those alternative forms of energy. I would imagine, you know, with your background, that you probably have a little bit of, well, insight maybe onto, can that be done? How is it done? How do we tap into these geothermal features for sustainable, consistent energy production without, you know, kind of wrecking the infrastructure underneath?
Well, I mean, geothermal is kind of having, you know, a big boom these days. There's a lot of new research going into geothermal energy, but there's different ways to do it. For example, you know, there's been a lot of proposals in the past for people to build geothermal power plants, you know, on the periphery of Yellowstone, but luckily those have been shut down because, again, even if you're drilling just outside of Yellowstone, you could tap into a major pathway of water and kill the surface features in Yellowstone.
And yeah.
That's happened. Like, for example, there's a very famous geothermal power plant area in California called the Geysers. And it's called the Geysers because there used to be geysers there, but ever since they've started drilling and harnessing geothermal power, there aren't any superficial geothermal features there anymore because they've destroyed them. So there are ways, though, that we are doing this now, where, for example, there's a research area in Utah called Forge, where we're researching how to drill into deep basement granitic rocks, fracturing them, so causing fractures, and then pumping water down into there and then recovering that water as it heats up in the ground and basically making a geothermal system and creating power that way. And that's something that's active areas of research right now, where you basically create your own geothermal system by creating man-made fractures and then pumping fluids through that and then recovering them.
Oh, that, I find that interesting. I mean, and is our underground network, how well do we understand it? There's a lot of carbon, and it's not on our plate here either. I just got a couple of minutes, but carbon capture. I think about, wow, how do you presume the ground is going to be steady enough to, you know, not leak carbon that gets pumped into caverns down there? I mean, is, you know, what's your thoughts on that as a seismologist?
Well, and that's one of the areas of research is as you fracture the ground, you know, as you, you know, pump high fluid, high pressure fluids in the ground and cause these fracture systems, you have to be really careful because you're causing earthquakes, right? So we record that and we monitor that. But the problem is, like you said, if you lose that fluid, if you cause too big of fractures, you could potentially cause a large enough earthquake to cause damage. It's happened in Europe and other places in the world, and those systems have had to be shut down. And the other thing is, we don't know where every single fault is in the earth. There are a lot of faults down there that don't make it to the surface, and we don't really know that they're there. So if you accidentally fracture into one of those natural faults and pump fluids into it, you could rupture that bigger fault too and cause a larger earthquake. So it's one of the major things that we are really careful about and are really researching to try to see if we could make these enhanced geothermal systems without potentially triggering larger damaging earthquakes.
Yeah, boy, I mean, talk about, playing with fire there. But again, you know, if we have confidence moving forward, it's something that worth exploring. Dr. Jamie Farrell again with us here. Let's look at going back here. And now we just got a couple of minutes, Cody, minute and a half. Thank you. The seismic and ground deformation that you noted earlier, that's happening kind of at the same time. That's unusual. Why is that unusual?
It's not, I wouldn't say it's unusual.
Okay.
What I would say is, you know, every time we see uplift, we don't always have seismic activity with it, but I wouldn't say it's unusual because we've seen it before in other things, you know, where we see, a swarm occur. It has ground deformation associated with the swarm, or other times where we've had uplift also in the Norris area where we've had seismicity. And in particular, there's this one, you know, notable area, 2013, 2014, we had this really concentrated area of uplift in the Norris area by somewhere near Norris Geyser Basin. And it was going up really fast, faster than we've ever recorded in Yellowstone. And this happened for about a year, maybe a little bit less. And then it culminated on March 30th, 2014, with a magnitude 4.8 earthquake.
Oh yeah,
and was the largest earthquake in Yellowstone in over 30 years.
You'll be happy to know if you find yourself hang gliding over Yellowstone National Park that the volcano alert level remains normal. The aviation code is green, so soar on. We are talking about seismic activity, volcanic activity, a recent earthquake outside of Great Falls, 4.2 on the Richter scale, some follow-ups as well. It's got us again, asking those questions about our Earth and what's underneath it here. Dr. Jamie Farrell back with us here from the Yellowstone Volcano Observatory. He's the chief seismologist there, as well as a research associate professor at the University of Montana, where he got his doctorate in geophysics there as well. And done a lot of work on Hebgen Lake, the fault there, and of course the Yellowstone region. Jamie, I always appreciate you coming on and talking about, these things that we kind of really know little about. I know there is a huge connectivity in this world. Like I say, the Earth is a closed system, so to speak. And so I always, appreciate how these things are connected. A couple of things maybe to clear up on. We'll get to that in just a little bit. I want to talk to start here because, as I noted, you go to the Caldera Chronicles, and it's easy to find, folks. Just type that in any search engine. It will be at the USGS.gov as well. And you look back at 2025, you guys are doing an upgrade to your seismic network. And I tell us about that. Are you replacing equipment that's 10 years old, 20 years old? What does the new stuff tell you that the old stuff didn't?
Yeah, so this is a long-term project that we started a few years back. And we upgrade, probably I'd say 2 to 3 stations a year. And what we're doing is, we're taking these old technology, seismometers. These are old analog, systems that only record ground shaking in one component, the vertical component. And we're upgrading those to modern digital three-component seismometers. So these are seismometers that can record a much larger band of frequencies of ground shaking, so we can record much more signals related to earthquakes. And they also record in three different directions, vertical, east-west, and north-south. So we're getting the full waveform of these earthquakes, and we can use that to better characterize the seismicity in Yellowstone. So that's one of them, is upgrading, you know, the old technology to newer technology, and we have about six stations left to do in the network. So we'll continue that this coming summer. And then the other thing is we're doing is we're adding the capability to try to monitor these geothermal basins. So, you know, the network is tailored to locating earthquakes. But we've actively avoided the hydrothermal basins because they're noisy and they mask the signals that we want to record earthquakes with. But what we're doing now is we're trying to add stations within those basins to try to see if we can figure out how to monitor these basins for activity that might tell us that, you know, maybe there's a feature that might explode, like a hydrothermal explosion, you know, like we saw in 2024 at Biscuit Basin. And, you know, the risk, the hazard and the risk of those hydrothermal explosions are kind of underappreciated in Yellowstone. And, you know, these things can be really large. Yellowstone is the home of the largest hydrothermal explosions on Earth, at least the ones that we know about. And these things can happen at any time. And if they happen in a busy summertime, when there's a lot of people around, they can really cause a lot of damage and potentially hurt people.
Yeah, it did catch people off guard, but I think, you know, lucky in that regard. Maybe go into that a little bit. You know, in terms of public safety, because we want to get close to these miracles, so to speak, but we need to do it safely. How will that new equipment then, you know, help in all the things that you're trying to accomplish?
Yeah, I mean, the idea here is that, you know, we don't really know if something's acting weird if we don't know how it acts normally, right? So if we can put instrumentation near some of these features, and over time we can understand, okay, this is how it acts normally, then if we know that, then we can say, okay, now it's acting different. Something has changed. Could this be leading up to, you know, something bigger? And so, like, there's no way we can do that unless we know what normal is. So, you know, we're always looking for transients or dynamics, something that's changing. So that's kind of the idea here, is that, you know, as long as we get enough instrumentation close to some of these features, then hopefully in the future we'll be able to tell if something different is happening, and maybe we can, you know, warn the Park Service, okay, this thing is acting weird. Maybe you want to reroute people away from this feature for a little bit.
Yeah, and then I'm going to go to Hawaii here in just a little bit, but just to finish up on some things that we were talking about before the break about normal seismicity, I guess that's the and then we also have this uplift area. Yeah, I guess I'm curious as to how, you know, that coupled leads to hydrothermal activity changes.
Yeah, so I mean, everything, you know, that's all related in Yellowstone, right? I mean, you have ground deformation, hydrothermal activity, earthquakes. It's all part of this active volcanic system. So understanding how one affects the other is something, you know, that we're really interested in. So, you know, ground deformation, you know, it causes earthquakes. Earthquakes can cause ground deformation. You know, earthquakes can cause changes in the hydrothermal system. So that's all things that we're looking at. And the more instrumentation we can have recording all of these signals, the better opportunity we have to put them all together and see how one relates to the other, and really understanding this dynamic system, and really understanding the associated hazards and risks to the people in the area. That's really the end goal, is a better understanding of what hazards are there, and you know, how does that translate into risk for infrastructure, for people, for all that stuff.
Right now, Cody's playing a little bit of this video from this eruption of Kilauea. I mean, it's just roaring. This looks like a lava stream that it's shooting I don't know. Is it 300 feet in the air?
You're way off. That last eruption shot over 1,500 feet in the air.
Oh, my gosh. Is that huge?
Yeah, it's amazing. It is amazing. Kilauea has really been putting on a show for the last year or so. And, you know, I think this latest one was episode, 41 in that ballpark. And it'll happen again. You know, it erupts, and then it goes in a lull for a little bit, and then, you know, in a couple weeks, it'll probably erupt again. Now, it doesn't always erupt 1,500 feet plus. Sometimes it's smaller, but it's really putting on a show. Kilauea is an amazing thing, and I would, you know, anybody has an opportunity to go see that, it's amazing. I was lucky enough to see one of these eruptions this last summer as I was doing some work on the volcano there this last summer, and absolutely amazing.
I bet. I was going to ask you, because, you know, as a seismologist, this stuff, we would geek over it, right? So there was no way you were not going to get to Hawaii to see this, right?
Yeah, I've been lucky enough to have a research project on Hawaii for the last few years, and we've been putting out some temporary seismometers on both Kilauea and Mauna Loa on the Big Island, trying to better understand how magma moves through the rift zones associated with those two volcanoes, and try to better understand how magma is stored underground and how it moves such far distances and erupts at the surface.
Oh, that's cool. Is that in connection with your work at the University of Utah?
Yeah, I mean, it's all part of my research on a volcano seismologist. So most of my research is on Yellowstone, but I do a little bit of work on Hawaii as well.
When you look back at 2025, what do you see are some things that kind of stand out to you about, even the Earth dynamic? I mean, there were some recent large earthquakes, 8.8 earthquake in Russia. Japan suffered one, 7.6. Maybe, you know, as you go to work on a day-to-day basis, you see those things kind of regularly. Do they stand out to you? What makes them stand out to you?
Well, I mean, an 8.8 earthquake is always going to stand out. That's a big earthquake. I mean, huge. The Earth produces, you know, earthquakes and, maybe one magnitude 8 earthquake a year on average, something like that. I don't know off the top of my head, but something around that. These are just massive earthquakes and, understanding these really big, we have a big subduction system off the Pacific Northwest of the U.S. capable of producing, magnitude 9 plus earthquakes. So the better that we can understand those really big destructive earthquakes that not only cause a lot of ground shaking but can cause large tsunamis, the better we'll all be as society, for sure.
Yeah. How far down can you see effectively? I mean, with your equipment.
I mean, yeah, we see all the way to the center of to the core of the Earth. I mean, the only way that we know what the core of the Earth is made up of, the different layers of the middle of the Earth are, is because of seismometers recording the different waves that travel through those different parts of the Earth. So the waves that we record in Yellowstone or even in Montana or anywhere, really, you can record large earthquakes that send waves down to the center of the Earth and back up to the surface. So we record it all.
But does that recording then, are you able to draw a fairly accurate maps, something above ground? Go ahead, yeah.
I mean, that, you know, it's a blurry image,
yeah.
Right?
It's not,
we don't know all the small details, but we're getting better. As we get better technology, more instrumentation, we're making better and better images and understanding more and more of what's happening under our feet. Of course, the closer you get to the surface of the Earth, the better image we have. For example, the Yellowstone volcanic system, the plumbing system and the magma reservoir that sits below Yellowstone. But thanks to seismology and the ability to record different seismic waves, we kind of know what the center of the Earth looks like and what it's doing.
Do we see pockets pop up? What shows up that's new in this area?
I don't know anything that's new. I mean, one reason why I love studying the Yellowstone region so much is that it's so dynamic, and we learn something new every year. Something different happens, and you know, in particular, the stuff that we've been doing with monitoring certain hydrothermal features in Yellowstone. We've been doing a lot of research lately on looking at individual thermal features and trying to figure out how those things work. And you know, we're using that to try to use, you know, geysers, eruptive systems, as analogs to larger volcanic eruptions, and see if we can, what we can learn from geysers and how they erupt, and see if we can apply that to volcanoes and see if we can get better understanding of what leads to an eruption and what maybe doesn't. So, you know, those types of things, we're always learning something new about these individual features and how they behave and maybe how they don't behave the way we thought they should. So it's always fun.
Yeah. You know, it's a kind of a stupid question, but you know, what scares you? You know, you're a scientist. This stuff happens every day. We feel an earthquake in Great Falls and we're going, what's going on here? But that's kind of like a day-to-day thing for you, right? What would scare you?
I don't know if anything would scare me. I mean, you know, everybody always asks, you know, anytime we put something out, say we're recording, you know, this seismic form in Yellowstone, is that going to lead to a volcanic eruption?
Yeah.
And, you know, our answer is always probably not. Yeah, this is not, this is just the way this volcano acts. You know, this is the normal for this volcano. If, you know, I always tell people, I don't know when the next eruption is going to occur. But I do know that if there was an eruption that was going to happen in Yellowstone, most likely it would be small, but also we would know it was going to happen. We have a good enough monitoring system in Yellowstone that we would see precursory activity in earthquakes, ground deformation, hydrothermal changes, gases. We would know it was coming. But I can't tell you at this point when it's going to happen.
Gotcha.
Not anytime soon, I can tell you that.
So good. As long as you're probably not, doesn't someday go to, well, probably.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. Hey, Jamie, I always appreciate chatting with you and the fun stuff that you get to do, right? But also how it connects to our world in ways that we don't really think about on a regular basis. So I appreciate that. Enjoy yourself, okay? Thank you, sir.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Yeah, Dr. Jamie Farrell, once again, chief seismologist, also with the University of Utah there, where he got his PhD, but also the Yellowstone Volcano Observatory. Don't forget, check it out, the Caldera Chronicles. A lot of good stuff there. Thanks for joining us for the podcast. And join us weekdays live from 9 a.m. to 10 a.m. for more Voices of Montana on great radio stations all across our Treasure State.